From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the Wisconsin Policy Forum looks at the challenges facing funding for special education here in the state.
Then we learn about the project to build a statue memorializing South Milwaukee native pro wrestler Da Crusher.
If the nationalization of wrestling would have occurred earlier, or if the Crusher somehow could have prolonged his career, you know, he was like Hulk Hogan. Before Hulk Hogan.
Plus, another Milwaukee native shares the distinct thrill of being a pro wrestling villain.
I'm the antagonist. That's what I like the best. So when I have a 85-year-old lady with thick glasses flipping me off and telling me how much she hates me, and you know that...
You've won.
And we'll remember a Wisconsin business and theater icon, Fred Foster, who died last week. Lake Effect is next, after the news.
It's Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Governor Tony Evers wants to increase state special education funding by $600 million over 2 years. The proposed increase follows a decade of flat state funding, despite rising costs to serve students with disabilities.
Making up for the deficit falls to local school districts, and many would be forced to slice funding for regular education programming in order to do so. High poverty and high minority districts are the most affected.
These are some of the conclusions in a new report by the Wisconsin Policy Forum. WUWM education reporter Emily Files spoke with Policy Forum researcher Ann Chapman.
The state has a constitutional responsibility and a responsibility by federal law to serve students with disabilities, and local school districts have a responsibility to provide it. Those costs tend to be much higher on average than regular education, but the state and federal funding to help offset those extra costs, those costs that wouldn't have otherwise occurred if the student did not have a disability, are not even close to the total cost that has to be spent. So what happens is local school districts have to cover the difference. And one thing to note in Wisconsin, local school districts, most of their revenues is capped at their revenue limit. So it's sort of a finite amount of money. If they have to pull from that general fund to help offset special education costs, that basically lowers the number of resources that can be used for all the rest of the students.
So the number that we hear a lot is that the state funding for special education has been flat and now only covers about a quarter of districts' actual additional costs for special education.
Exactly. So the state has a number of ways that it funds special education, but there's one primary funding source, and that source has been flat for 10 years. Meanwhile, costs have been rising.
The article points out that the burden of using general funds to pay for special education falls most heavily on high poverty, high minority districts, including the three districts in Wisconsin that serve the largest numbers of Native American students. So tell me about how that happens and some of the concerns that it raises.
Sure. So if you look across the state at all the 420-some districts that are here and you rank them in terms of the percentage of that flat revenue limit that I talked about that has to be used to cover special education, the top 10 districts are small and in many cases higher poverty districts. And like you said, three of the districts in that top 10 have the state's highest district populations of Native American students. So for example, the Menominee Indian School District has to divert about a quarter of their revenue limit to cover special needs. So that means a quarter of their main source of resources is not available for all the rest of the students.
This report also talks about how a new voucher program plays into the special education funding picture. Can you talk about that?
A new program was created about 3 years ago to provide scholarships to students with disabilities whose parents wish to enroll them in a private school. So this is a pretty new program. It's relatively small, but it's been growing very fast. That scholarship actually comes out of the state aid of the resident school district.
And then the resident school district can raise property taxes to make up that revenue if they choose to.
Exactly.
So what did you find about how Wisconsin's special education funding compares to other states? Is it unusual the way that we fund special education?
It is somewhat unusual. Wisconsin's system of funding using this reimbursement method is only one of only five states that do it this way. And among the five states that do it this way, Wisconsin reimburses at the lowest rate. So Wisconsin's at about 25%. The highest is Wyoming, which reimburses at 100%. So the range is that, you know,
wow,
between. So what do the other states do? So the vast majority of other states, about 33, actually embed special ed funding right into their funding formula. So maybe they weight students with disabilities a little bit higher than regular students, and that is built right into the funding formula.
This idea of weighting special needs students so that they receive a higher per pupil amount, that is actually not the solution that's on the table right now when we're talking about the Blue Ribbon Commission on School Funding that has this raft of recommendations on ways to make education funding better in Wisconsin. They are proposing increasing the reimbursement rate, but not changing the formula. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. So this Blue Ribbon Commission, they released a number of proposals, and these are basically suggestions to the legislature and the governor. We don't know what will be taken up officially in the budget proceedings, but it is interesting that they chose to handle special education in the same way that they always have, but proposed increasing the reimbursement. Conversely, if you look at some of the other vulnerable student populations that the Blue Ribbon Commission addressed, students in poverty, English language learners, the commission suggested weighting them higher in the formula. And that was just as a direction that they went, that they chose not to go with special education. It's an interesting observation. There are probably pluses and minuses to both.
It does seem like special education funding is having a moment right now in terms of being something that people are rallying around as an issue that needs to be addressed by the legislature. So we talked about the Blue Ribbon Commission a little bit, but there's also this major proposal from Governor Tony Evers. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. So in Governor Evers' budget that he proposed before he was elected governor, when he was superintendent of Department of Public Instruction, he proposed a $600 million increase over a two-year period for special education. That is by far the largest line item increase in the education budget of any other item. And so that's one of the reasons why I think special education is having its moment. But the question is, why was that chosen as was one of the areas that, you know, Superintendent Evers decided to focus on? And it seems to be because of this cascading effect it has on overall education. And because we already have inequities between school districts, when you add on to that this, large chunk of a school district's given general fund that has to be, you know, sort of sliced off the top to fund special education, many people think it's exacerbating the inequities we already have.
Wisconsin Policy Forum researcher Ann Chapman spoke with WUWM's Emily Files. The Policy Forum's report on special education funding is available through a link on our website, wuwm.com. Coming up next, the Crusher statue in South Milwaukee will memorialize a pro wrestling legend. A look at his career and the early days of pro wrestling when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM. Back now with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. You may know the beer that made Milwaukee famous, but how about the man? Reggie "The Crusher" Lisowski was a pro wrestler from South Milwaukee whose career spanned from the 1950s through the 1980s. His tagline, "The Man Who Made Milwaukee Famous," was a nod to his character, which was pure Milwaukee.
The Crusher was a blue-collar, beer-drinking man who ate Polish sausage and came on stage to polka music. This persona is part of what endeared him to Chris Smith, a South Milwaukee native and the organizer of a project seeking to build a statue in honor of Crusher.
Much to Smith's surprise, the project quickly reached its funding goal, and the statue is set to be unveiled in downtown South Milwaukee on June 8th of this year. Smith sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about Crusher's career and the early days of pro wrestling.
The thing about the Crusher was he reached his height of popularity and peaked just like all people do, wrestlers, celebrities, whatever. And he was winding down at the end of his career just as wrestling kind of got into the mainstream in the 80s with Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant and all those guys. And Crusher, you know, wrestled a little bit for the WWF right at the end of his career, part-time. But if the nationalization of wrestling would have occurred earlier, or if the Crusher somehow could have prolonged his career, you know, he was like Hulk Hogan before Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan actually learned from him. They came up in the same company, which was called the AWA, and it was based out of Minneapolis. And so they wrestled all over the place. Crusher wrestled all over the planet, but primarily it was a Midwest territory. And so that's why he's still very popular among the baby boomer generation, especially Milwaukee, because no matter where he wrestled, he was announced, you know, the man that made Milwaukee famous. And so he reached a pretty significant, at least in the Midwest and especially in Wisconsin, I mean, you could definitely consider him a celebrity at the time.
So he was the PBR of wrestlers.
Absolutely. I mean, he was very, just very Milwaukee.
As someone who is not so familiar with, you know, the history of WWE, the history of wrestling, professional wrestling more generally mm-hmm. in the U.S., what was it like in the 1960s, 1970s, compared to what we might think of more in the 80s and even now?
It's an interesting history. I mean, you go back to the 50s and wrestling was covered like any sport is now. In the newspapers, and people followed it like it was a legitimate sporting competition. Now we know, and most suspected, or maybe in the 50s, not most, but some suspected, that it was scripted, okay? And it still is. But, you know, wrestlers to this day do not appreciate anyone, you know, claiming that it's fake because the pain is real, and these are, and Crusher was a terrific athlete. His tag team partner, Dick the Bruiser, played for the Packers. So, I mean, they're real athletes. It's absolutely real. But, you know, the endings are and probably always were scripted. So back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, this was what they call the territorial days. And you had Vince McMahon Sr. in the Northeast, based in New York City. And you had someone called Vern Gagne, who was based out of Minneapolis, and he ran the AWA. And then you had the Mid-South, and you had the Houston wrestling. You had a bunch of territories, and they were very territorial, and they respected each other's territories. And the AWA, which covered the Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, was very successful. A lot of the wrestlers that the younger generations have heard about, it wouldn't be unusual for them to come through the AWA, like Hulk Hogan, Big John Studd, Bobby the Brain Heenan, Mean Gene Okerlund. They all came through the AWA. And so what ended up happening in the 80s, Vince McMahon Sr., who ran what was first called the WWWF, but then they shortened it to just the WWF, he sold the company to his son, Vince McMahon Jr., and Vince McMahon Jr. did something that no one ever did and that really the other promoters didn't like. He basically bought airtime in every territory. Just long story short, nationalized wrestling. And it was a success. The other territories fought him. but he was making enough money that he could lure the big stars like Hulk Hogan from the AWA. And then it just, in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, it got extremely popular. They teamed up with MTV, did something called Rock and Wrestling, and at the time, very popular celebrities got involved, like Mr. T and Cyndi Lauper. And so it just kind of took off, and the territories kind of died. And so Crusher was absolutely one of the most popular wrestlers in the territories. And unfortunately, when Vince McMahon Jr. kind of took over, he did bring Crusher on, but it was in a very part-time basis because he was just older, and he just was at the end of his career at that point. So I also work kind of for the city of South Milwaukee, where Crusher was from, and so decided something needed to be done about this because someone who was so popular and so successful, but also on the other side of the coin, away from wrestling, by all accounts, just a very good and generous human being, I figured, like, you know, if we don't do something, my kids aren't going to know who he is. And my kids' kids certainly won't know who he is. So hopefully with this project we're working on here, that will maintain his memory.
Yeah. To just go back a little bit to, you know, the kinds of personas that you get with wrestling. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, you know, in the 1950s, it was regarded as this kind of, you know, very real sport. Mm-hmm. But there is that scripted element of it now and in the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the personas are a big part of that and a big part of what really made the Crusher mm-hmm. who he was. Can you give us some, you know, he was the Milwaukee guy. Can you give us some examples of how that manifested in his character?
Absolutely. I mean, your character, you know, and wrestlers now call it your gimmick, okay? Mm-hmm. You have to have something that gets the crowd interested in you. You know, wrestler's worst nightmare is you're out there, you're getting announced, and the crowd does nothing. They want you either booing or they want you cheering, okay? Either one is good. You know, so over the decades, wrestlers come up with a character. Andre the Giant was the big, mean, nasty giant. You know, before that, he was a good guy too. But, you know, you had cowboys. You had a guy from Canada who called himself Rowdy Roddy Piper, who wore a kilt and acted like he was from Scotland. And you had people in masks, and you had people who were like, you know, voodoo priests. You had Native American characters, you know. So Crusher's character, if you will, I don't know how much different it was from who he was as a person, because it was, he would come out to polka music. He would call himself the man that made Milwaukee famous. He would do interviews and talk about, you know, back in Milwaukee, he won the crown of Mr. Saloon 10 years in a row, and that's because he could eat the most polar sausage and drink the most beer and throw the drunks out of the saloon and do the polka. And very famously, he would say his workout consisted of running along the shores of Lake Michigan with a keg of beer on his shoulder. And when his workout was over, the keg was empty. You know, so that was his character, and it was probably very much inspired by who he really was, because he grew up in South Milwaukee, went to South Milwaukee High School. He raised a family there, and I work in that town. I work for the city, and if I had a dollar for every Crusher story I've heard from people there, I'd have a lot more money than I do now.
You know, you mentioned the beer barrel, running mm-hmm. around with a beer barrel, and he himself was a very barrel-chested yeah. kind of guy, not exactly who you would look at and say, oh, that man's a wrestler.
Yeah, he, you know, he didn't have the physique of like a bodybuilder like some wrestlers do, especially in the 80s, a lot of them did. But he was built, and he was thick, and he was strong. And in this process here of creating this statue, I've worked closely with the Crusher's daughters, which has been very much a joy for me. And Crusher measured all his measurements, his biceps, his chest, and they kept that. And so the statue is actually going to mirror that. And he was a big, stout guy. Now, his physique changed as he got older a little bit, but he was always a big, strong man.
for someone who is able to have a very long career, considering what his career was, you have to imagine he was very fit.
Right. And before he could wrestle full time, and before he started wrestling, he, you know, was a blue-collar worker. He was a bricklayer. He had a bunch of jobs that were all very physical. And then he became successful enough wrestling that he could do that full time.
So you mentioned you've been working with his daughters mm-hmm. to get this statue built. You know, what is that process like actually getting, I mean, first of all, getting the place to put the statue, getting, I'm assuming there's permits involved with that, mm-hmm. and then getting really the momentum in the community to get this thing built and building it.
Well, you know, going back to raising the money, I mean, I talked to a number of different places that could create the statue, and pretty much my target was $40,000. And honestly, I anticipated this being something that would kind of just mirror my career. I'm 40. I just turned 40. And I thought, over the next 20, 25 years, you know, I'll try to do this. And then hopefully, by the time I retire, I'll have enough money that I can kick in whatever we need and then get this thing done. And, you know, it just goes to show that still, you know, I mean, we're 14 years after his death. He died in 2005. How much people still love him. I launched the website in very late December, after Christmas, 2017, and we were fully funded by March. So 3 months, basically. And we actually got more donations than we even thought we needed. And so then the process of actually creating the statue, we picked a very reputable firm in Milwaukee called Vanguard Sculpture Services. The owner actually went to South Milwaukee High School, knew the Crusher's daughters, so it was kind of very cool. And I've had a lot of people in the city come up to me and say, oh, you're so popular for doing this. Because it's a very, I mean, in 2019, 2018, pretty much it doesn't seem like people can agree on anything. But social media, you got to really search for a negative comment about the Crusher statue, okay? We're not asking for public money. It was all privately funded. And pretty much the response has been super positive. And so I've had people come up to me and say, whoa, you're very popular in South Milwaukee right now because you're behind this. And I would always reply to them, yeah, but if the statue turns out and looks like crap, my name will be mud. But very recently we have seen, and the Crusher's daughters and myself have seen, the final clay sculpture, and we gave it the green light to go forward to make the mold, to get, you know, whatever this process is, to have it made out of bronze. And I am no longer worried about my name being mud over this, at least, because it looks wonderful.
So it's going to be erected pretty soon, right?
Yeah, June 8th.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What are your plans moving forward for the statue?
It's very close. I mean, we're within a couple months probably of it being finished. And then June 8th is the date that we picked for the unveiling. There's a spot for it in the city, kind of right in the heart of the city. South Milwaukee does have like a natural downtown, and their main street is called Milwaukee Avenue, and it's right 11th and Milwaukee. And so once the snow melts, if that ever happens, we have a bunch of companies that have agreed to donate labor and materials to turn the little parcel that the city has dedicated to where the statue will go. They're going to turn it into like a miniature park. The local bricklayers union, a big landscaping company called KEI Landscaping, and a company called Miller Monuments. They're all coming together, totally volunteer, and they're going to turn this little parcel, which right now is part of a parking lot, into a park. And it's going to be a brick plaza. And the part where the statue is going to go is going to be in the middle of a 20 by 20 brick square, which is the same dimensions of a wrestling ring. So it's going to be a very, I think, cool little spot for the statue to call home.
Nice. Well, I look forward to seeing it. And thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Smith is the organizer of the Crusher statue, which will be unveiled on June 8th of this year. Smith spoke with Lake Effect Joy Powers. There is more information about the project at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, we'll learn about the heyday of pro wrestling in Milwaukee, at least from the perspective of one former villain. That's coming up next on Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we heard about Da Crusher, a Milwaukee pro wrestling legend whose statue will be unveiled in June.
Another Milwaukee native, Chris Malterer, known professionally as Chris Curtis, also made a name for himself in the world of pro wrestling. He spent more than 25 years in the ring, competing largely in the Midwest against some well-known opponents, including national names like Hulk Hogan and Jesse Ventura.
I spoke with Malterer in 2014. At the time, he'd been retired for about a decade, but he had recently written a book about his time in the ring. Job Man, My 25 Years in Professional Wrestling was co-written by local author Larry Wyden. Malterer began our conversation with defining the term job man.
That's a wrestling term that's used throughout the business. And so that's what we did. We went out, we did a job for a guy and put him over, made him look good. And you don't make yourself look good, you make him look good. Although in the process of doing all that, we make ourselves look like we're professionals too.
Well, but you were a professional.
Correct, yes. And we're out there to make wrestling look believable, even though it's not. And so when I was in the ring, I made sure that when I was doing my job, making the star look good, I made sure everything was crisp. It was tight and
that the audience bought it.
Right. That's the biggest thing. You have to make sure that the audience bought it, because if something was off a little bit, and it happens, they catch on real quick. And so you have to sometimes ad lib, and you know, it's, you're on the spot. There's no do-overs out there. So, yeah.
Well, talk a little bit about that kind of agreement that the audience has with professional wrestling. I mean, people know, on some level, I think that it's, I don't want to say not real, because you're actually out there doing things and right. You're making it work, but you're not fighting to the death, literally.
Correct. We're out there basically working a play. That's what we're doing. There's two athletes that are working a play, and there's a start of the play, there's the middle of the play, and then there's the finish, the ending of the play. But while we're out there, you have to make sure you keep those people guessing, even though there's people out there that say, well, no, this is not on the up and up. It's not on the level. You still keep them guessing. And that's why you go all out, but you're not out there to hurt your opponent.
So, right. What I like about it is that it's very much theater.
Correct. And if we were actually out there trying to hurt each other, there would be no professional wrestling. The business would be dead. It would be gone, because there would be nobody left. What we do is we work a match, and it goes on to the next week and the next week and the next week, and you keep building on that every single week, day, month.
So the story gets added to?
The story gets added to it, and there's just so many different levels that you can carry it on to. It's kind of like a flower. It blooms and it gets bigger and bigger, and you know, finally the flower can't go anymore, so you start with something new, and just before that ends. So
one of the things that you also do in pro wrestling is you have characters that are in this play. So talk about your character, Chris Curtis.
My main thing, I was the heel. I was the villain. It came natural to me, because when I was a kid, for whatever reason, I was always obnoxious and getting into trouble. Not serious trouble, but just obnoxious trouble. And I would go out in the ring and bait the crowd, do whatever I could to get them riled up. And while I was working the babyface, the good guy, a heel is out there to make the babyface look strong. We're basically the weaker, and so that's why we resort to cheating and underhanded tactics, because we can't legitimately overtake them. So many times too, the good guy, the baby face, would be the very muscular, stronger, better looking, that type of thing, the more athletic, where a heel was not as built as they were, but we still are very good athletes. Our job was to get the ire of the crowd.
Well, I've looked at some of the pictures in the book, and I have to say, you know, in your younger days, you could have certainly been a baby face if you'd wanted to. You look sort of angelic with your curly hair. You know, you had just like these nice expressions and everything. Mm-hmm. So did you use that to make people think you were something different than the heel that you were in this character?
You know, I never really thought about that. I just went out there and I was just being me. And I never over-exaggerated because people can sense that. That's the way the business is nowadays. You get a lot of guys, they over-exaggerate their mannerisms. I never did that. I just went out there and did what I had to do. And you just, you know, I could just look at somebody and really tick them off. So it was a thing where I guess I just used my natural good looks to tick off people.
And you also, one of the things that was just, I have to say, I sort of shuddered as I was reading the book, was the list of injuries that you sustained doing all of this, doing your job as the job man and making these guys look good. My goodness, rotator cuff, knees, concussion, what else?
I broke my hand. I tore my rotator cuff wrestling Victor the Bear. That was before I got into wrestling. I would have to tape my knees up. I probably dislocated my kneecaps completely at least a dozen times. I bruised my kidneys, had a couple concussions, split my head open probably a dozen times, that kind of stuff.
And is that typical for anyone who's in this business?
More often than not, it's usually knee injuries or hip injuries. A lot of the old timers now, they've had hip replacements, knee replacements. They've had their discs in their back fused. A lot of them are in wheelchairs, walkers. I'm lucky I didn't end up like that. But those guys also wrestled 7,000 to 10,000 matches throughout their career, and they were in the business 35 to 40 years. So they did it full time. I did it part time. So 700 matches to 800 matches is still a lot. But I'm still pretty healthy. My knees are bad. They're getting a little worse now. So, but you had to go out there. You had no choice. If you didn't work, you didn't get paid. So if you hurt, you had to deal with it.
How did you train and learn how to do the falls and how to do the kinds of things you did in the ring to not really hurt each other, but to make it look like you were?
I actually went to a training camp for about 3 months down in a, used to be a little pool room on 2nd off of National. I had a ring set up. And we learned how to work holds. We learned how to fall correctly without hurting ourselves. We learned how to flip, learn how to go over the top rope, that kind of thing. The most important part about falling is tucking your head, protecting the back of your head. And so you do this continually 5 days a week over a 3 month period, and that's what I did. Then you learn how to work a match and so forth. It's all on the job training. But yeah, it takes a long time to make sure that you know how to fall, because you land the wrong way, especially on your neck or the back of your head, and you could be crippled for life.
Yeah, or die.
It's happened.
Yeah.
So.
Now, when you talk about, you know, working a match, in the book you talked about meeting up with the superstars that you were jobbing for and talking about what you were going to do. Was that always the case? You talk ahead of time and like, okay, this is the story and this is how we're going to do it. You knew the moves and that sort of thing?
Yeah. A good example would be like Greg Gagne. I wrestled Greg in the AWA probably a couple dozen times. Basically what you would do, and I'm using him as an example, you meet up beforehand. They tell you how many minutes you're going to go. You might go 10 to 12 minutes. You work out possibly a beginning, what you're going to do, a couple of high spots. And a high spot, Bonnie, is when you see the guys hit the ropes back and forth, that's called a high spot. And then you always come up with a finish. You don't want to go over too much because the crowd might not be buying what you're doing. So the heel, which would be me, we would always, you know, if I had to improvise, I would do that. The heel always called the match in the ring. So if you have the guy in a headlock, basically you're almost a ventriloquist because you talk to the guy and you try not to move your lips. And so you basically go over everything and you see how the crowd reacts. But yeah, you always come up with a little something beforehand. Sometimes there were situations where if you were in a certain town and you had a baby face dressing room and a heel dressing room that was completely on the opposite side of the auditorium or whatever the case may be, you called everything in the ring. And so that was it. The finish, what would happen would be usually the referee would give you the finish when you get in the ring while you're waiting for the other guy, because the booker of the territory would give the referee the finish, and then from there you would just work something out in there.
To get to that finish.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and then we would call it. So it's not as easy as it looks. You got to make sure that it comes off right. Otherwise, if it falls apart, it's not a good situation.
Well, not only do you have to, you know, make a scenario that works for the two of you, but you've got to get the crowd believing you too.
Correct. And there's certain things that you also do. You have different matches in the card. You have the opener and you have an added attraction and a special attraction and a semifinal and a main event. You're not going to give everybody everything in an opening match. I worked a lot of opening matches, and I loved it because it's my job, it's our job to get the crowd warmed up. So you're going to give them a few things, and then the next match will give them a little bit more, and then the match after that's going to give them more, and then the main event gives them pretty much everything. So it's all a matter of what they're going to buy.
But that's your skill. I mean, you have to be able to turn on a dime.
Exactly. And that's the thing. You cannot be afraid of the audience. You have to be in control of the crowd. If you're not in control of the crowd, you're going to freeze up and it's going to be a disaster. Being a heel, we have a different personality than the good guy, the baby face. We have to go in there with that devil-may-care personality that I'm in charge, you're not, and that's that. And you're going to buy what we're doing, and if they don't like it, I'm going to get on the audience, and they might start responding, but we're the ones who control everything.
Villains are always more fun to play.
Oh, yeah. I was a natural. I mean, I've worked as a babyface before. It's okay, but that's not me. I'm the antagonist. That's what I like the best. So when I have a 85-year-old lady with thick glasses flipping me off and telling me how much she hates me, and you know that
you've won.
Exactly.
Yeah, you made it. Mm-hmm. Now that you are retired from this.
Yes, for 10 years.
How do you stay in touch with it? Do you?
No. I don't watch it anymore. The business has changed so much from what it used to be. I want nothing to do with what's going on out there today. It's too soap opera-like. It's not even wrestling anymore. It's more glorified bodybuilders, combination, gymnasts. I mean, they're great athletes, don't get me wrong, but it's not wrestling. It's not like it used to be.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing a little bit of your very colorful past with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Chris Malterer, known to wrestling fans as Chris Curtis, is the author of Job Man, My 25 Years in Professional Wrestling, co-written by local author Larry Wyden. Our interview first aired in 2014.
We'll take one more break and then listen back to an interview with the founder of a lighting control company who revolutionized the industry. We'll remember Fred Foster when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM.
More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Finally today, Fred Foster died last week. Foster was truly an icon in American stagecraft, though unless you work as a lighting designer or technician, you probably didn't know his name or his company. He and his brother Bill founded the Middleton-based company ETC in the 1970s, and the company revolutionized theater lighting systems.
Foster was interviewed by our How Did You Do That podcast hosts, Kathleen Gallagher and Tim Keene, last year. He described pitching his initial idea as an 18-year-old student at UW-Madison to Gilbert Hemsley, who was on the faculty but also a lighting supervisor for the New York City Opera.
Getting Gilbert's attention was a challenge for anyone, and especially as a freshman in a department that had 160 undergraduates and about a dozen graduate students, all who got Gilbert's attention well ahead of ours. And we had the idea of building a computerized light board. There was one at the university that was installed in 1973 for $150,000, and my brother, who's a couple years older than I am, and one of his high school friends and one of our buddies from sailboat racing got together and said, we should do this. And my brother took one look at this thing and said, gack, this is disgusting. We can do it for $5,000. So we went over to Gilbert's house, made an appointment to see him at a Christmas Eve party. And Gilbert threw great parties. And eventually we had an opportunity to meet with him and whoever happened to be in the room. And we said, we're going to build a Q-file, which was the name of that earlier computer. And everyone around the room looked at us and said, yeah, sure. So that kind of pissed us off and gave us the reason to keep going.
That's where Gilbert Hemsley's expertise and his teaching style came in.
Gilbert was a mentor in really an artistic sense, more than a business sense. As one of the beauties of his program and the way he taught was he took his students out when he worked professionally. So in my first year of school, I got to spend 2 weeks in New York City when he was lighting two operas at the Met. And basically, I got sandwiches for the design table, but I got this is when I fell in love with opera houses.
But Fred says when he started out, he and his brother didn't think of themselves as entrepreneurs.
We started with a goal of building a computerized light board. Our original fantasy was we were going to sell it to a company for $150,000 and be rich for the rest of our lives. That didn't turn out to be true. But I don't think our motivation was to build a business or to command, control, or lead the market. We just had an idea that we wanted to do. It crossed a bunch of the passions of my brother doing the software, Gary doing the hardware, me doing the lighting, kind of product, what would be product management, I guess. And Jim Bradley was involved as well. So it was, we were young, it was something to do, and I guess that's how it started.
So let me go back to Gilbert for a minute. If he had 160 or 200 students, mm-hmm. he certainly couldn't spend the kind of time he spent with you guys with everybody.
He didn't actually spend that much time with us. I mean, we from the Christmas party in 1975, it was a year and a day later on Christmas Day of 1976 when we dropped our first computer down on his coffee table at a party, which is arguably the same party that was going on the whole year. And we set this down, and the general reaction of a lot of the people who were there, who were also in that first meeting, was, oh, you've done it. Now what are you going to do? And by this time, I'd worked at the Met, and I smiled broadly and said, we're going to sell it to the Met, which was a total pipe dream. But where Gilbert reentered is that he had arranged a production of an opera that was put on by the Madison Opera Guild. It was Manon. And it was going to be the first time that an opera was shown live on color television, on public broadcasting. It was broadcast on stereo radio because there was no such thing as a color stereo television, and there was going to be a live audience. So this was the first time that had been done, and they decided and agreed to use our computerized light board because that would make Gilbert's show even bigger, because arguably a lot of this was about Gilbert. And so at this production, while it was rocky getting it going, there was a man named Clem D'Alessio from the Metropolitan Opera, and Gilbert brought him back on opening night and proudly said, and here is a switchboard that my students have made. And Clem pushed one button on it and blacked the entire theater out. Not just the theater, but the dressing rooms and the offices and the lobby. So it's fair to say we didn't get the order. Gilbert knew somebody who worked at Kleagle, which is the biggest company in the day. And he arranged for us to go to a trade show, and we thought we were going to sell the board to Kleagle. And so Bill and I loaded it up into a plywood box and carried it, went down to Washington, D.C. and unpacked it in our room and went to the Kleagle hospitality suite before the show opened. And there in the middle of the hospitality suite was a computer that did everything that ours did. And we were totally crushed. But we licked our wounds. We went down to the trade show floor the next day and went to the smallest lighting company we could find and said, we have a light board to show you. And here a great man who ran this company called Hub Electric came up. He saw this and he said, you know, boys, this is too big a product for my company, but you should keep going. And that was a really gracious thing for him to do. And I remember it very distinctly 40 years on. Because what he basically did was to give us another kick in the butt to keep going.
They kept at it and eventually got a contract to sell the electronics, the software, and a floppy disk drive to a company for $5,000. The company turned around and sold it for $30,000. But as his schooling ended, his brother and other partners left the company to pursue their own careers, and Fred and a handful of employees were left building lighting consoles in a garage.
And it was a matter of being too stupid to quit.
What really got you on track with the business? You know, did you have any mentors who helped you sort out how to run this business, how to grow it?
I think probably Bob Gilson is one of the people who helped us, and his father, Warren. Bob's father, Warren, started a company called, at that time, Gilson Medical Electronics, now called Gilson Incorporated.
A Madison company that makes instruments for pharmaceutical and biotech companies?
Yeah. Basically, imagine any device that takes a drop of liquid out of one test tube and puts it in a bunch of others. And Bob and his father were very generous with their facilities, inviting all of Bob's friends in on the weekend to use the equipment. And we met Bob through sailboat racing, and we actually, the first time I went to his factory was when we had broken the top of our mast off when we tipped our boat over, and he could weld aluminum, and we put it together. But the fact that Bob and Warren would let us use their factory, I'd go in on the weekend, I'd wait in the parking lot until one of them showed up so I could get in, and Bob's way of teaching me to use a machine was, here's a power switch, and then he told me how I broke it. but their generosity was incredible. We couldn't have been in business without his support. When we moved from my brother's bedroom at my parents' house to our first true garage, it was in a building Bob built for us and another one of his friends who was starting a business.
From that auspicious beginning in a dorm room and then a garage, ETC has grown and now has 1,100 employees and is in 10 countries around the world. All of their manufacturing is still done in Wisconsin.
So tell us about that growth curve from three guys in Bob Gilson's shop to today.
The first 2 years, we didn't have any money. We didn't pay ourselves. Then we got the contract, the OEM contract with Colortran, and in about 1978. So by 1983, we were maybe eight people with under $1 million of revenue, so it was a very flat growth curve. But we actually started paying ourselves, which was nice. And then Bill and Gary both continued on with their schooling. And in 1979, we got a deal through Colortran to build a parade control system for Disneyland. And that started a relationship with Disney that now is 35 years old. And it's now to a point when Disney builds a theme park, we basically get an order for one theme park and provide all of the lighting control. And that's because over the years, we've worked with them to develop a special control system really just for them. And we have serviced the hell out of them.
But initially, the competition was rough.
The business had four major companies: Strand, which was owned by the Rank organization in England; Klegel, which was a perennial leader; Colortran; and then a company called Electro Controls. Those four companies made computerized lighting consoles, dimmers, and spotlights. And here we only made the consoles. And we were challenged by this because we would try to bid against the big guys on an entire theater project, and they had a great argument. They said that, why would you want to buy a lighting system from ETC and Lighting Methods Incorporated? Because when the lights blink, they're going to point fingers at each other. But we make the whole system, we'll support the whole system. And as soon as we heard that, I think that was one of the events that triggered an ethical platform in our company. We knew that we could never let that happen. And so that's why we started 24/7/365 telephone support. In the early days, it was my home telephone number. But that service ethic has continued to this day, and it's really one of the reasons why we have grown, where there are very few vestiges left of the names that I mentioned a few minutes ago.
As his business grew, Fred and his company started to diversify and offer more products. That became easier after ETC acquired the Rochester, New York company, Lighting Methods, after working in partnership with them for a time.
But it also put the combined company in a real money crunch.
So that created a real situation. This was, again, when I learned the business phrase of what a debt-to-equity ratio was. I didn't know this. And it turns out that we had an 8-to-1 debt-to-equity ratio, which is functionally bankrupt. At the time, if you had a 2-to-1 debt-to-equity ratio, your bank executive could loan you the money. If it was a 3-to-1, they'd have to go to the board of directors of the bank. But an 8-to-1 was way out there. Keeping in mind, we had moved 25 people from Rochester to Madison. We had added another 40 people, and we were 85 people at the end of the year. And I had to stand up in front of the company in a company meeting and say, so, we have a real problem. We're almost out of business. We had a plan. The bank approved our plan to work it out, but it required concessions from the employees. So we put in wage freezes, we stopped free lunch on Monday, we kept the free coffee, we needed that. And then we put in the first phase of our bonus plan, because what I've realized since looking back on it is there are times when a company, we had to transfer some of the risk to the employees. And by putting in wage freezes, we were asking them to share some of the risk.
So and what happened? How many did you lose?
Well, the bonus plan was very simple. We figured out what we had to ship in a month. Let's say it was $800,000. For every $25,000 over the budget, everybody got $5. And that went on for about 3 levels. And then everybody got $8. And everybody got $15. Everybody. I got the same bonus as the person packing boxes or building a product or engineering a product. By the end of the year, we had given out in bonuses more than we would have done if we would have given 5% pay raises. So they did well by the risk they took, and we didn't lose a single person. And if you look at the names of the people who were employed in 1992, I guess, a surprising number of them are still with us. And that's also when I started to realize that the biggest asset we have isn't our technology. It isn't where we live. It's the people we have.
It's been a long run. And we're hoping, we know that there are a lot of entrepreneurs listening to this. So the question is, what was the hardest part of this? And what would you tell other people to pay attention to as they find themselves in the same growing environment?
The hardest part is actually, in my mind, the most satisfying part, which is creating a company or an environment where now 1,000 people can explore their passion and share whatever their particular passion is, they can contribute towards a cause that they care about.
Fred Foster, speaking last year with Tim Keane and Kathleen Gallagher on WUWM's How Did You Do That podcast. The founder of the Middleton-based theater lighting company ETC, or Electronic Theater Controls, passed away last week. He was 61. And that is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air is next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.